Hello and welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast that is still about music, the dance floor and counterculture. And my name is still Tim Lawrence and I'm still here as joined as always by my good friend Jem Gilbert. Hi Jem.
Hi, hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Hi, hi. So remarkably, I don't think we ever thought we would live to reach the moment when we surpass both Breaking Bad and The Wire in terms of longevity. But we are at the start of series six. Let's just dwell on that for a moment before we decide to just get on with it. And we, for this new series, we have now come out of a series in which we interviewed lots of people who've written books about on topics that related to the first five series that we had, four series, sorry, that we had completed. And for patrons, we covered some developments between 1970 and 76 in the UK and Europe. And we are now really going to be coming back to the United States, which means we'll be mainly focusing on New York City, but not necessarily exclusively, for this year, 1977. And although it may appear that we're not making particularly rapid progress in our charge through history, 1977 is an iconic year in New York City for many different reasons, and it was also an iconic year in the development of DJ culture and disco for many reasons, and lots was going on besides. So that's what we'll be focusing on this series. But to open things up and to cover one thing that we felt we haven't quite devoted enough specific attention to, in particular for the wider listenership, because we have been dwelling on some of these topics in recordings for patrons, is this question of punk. And punk does also come through very, very strongly in 1977, but its roots can be traced back to a much earlier point in time. And arguably, punk also reached a certain peak in 1976. So today we are going to record the first of three episodes on punk music and punk culture.
So what we're going to try to do in these first three episodes of Series 6, where we talk about the genesis of punk rock as a musical concept, what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about the genesis of the idea of punk rock. We're going to talk about three key seminal tracks that are definitive in that history. What we'll do next time is talk about how you get from that point when the term punk rock starts to be used around 1972 to the end of 1976, at the moment when Anarchy in the UK gets released. And then finally, we will talk about the broad context for that historic musical event, the release of the Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK. Sound good, Tim?
Sounds fantastic.
But today it is really the genealogy of punk rock up to the moment when Anarchy in the UK gets released at the end of 76. So this term punk, this word punk, has a long etymology in the English language, and it is first used as a term for a prostitute in the 16th century. That's the earliest usage of it. And at some point by the early 20th century, it's turned into a slang term for a young criminal, kind of young, inexperienced criminal. You know, it has some of the connotations of sort of subordination and subservience, that and youthfulness as well, that it carries with it from that earlier meaning. But the term punk, referring to a kind of music or a kind of attitude in music, term punk rock, you know, it first starts to get used around 1972 and then brought, or maybe 1970, 71. And then punk as a kind of style, as a genre of music, as an attitude, starts to be talked about more widely and more generally observed until you get to around 1977, and you can very clearly say that there is a thing called punk out there. There is something in the culture called capital P punk, and its music is punk rock, but it also encompasses a certain kind of fashion sensibility and a whole kind of attitude. And I think, to some extent, even from that moment, perhaps even, you know, from the early 70s, and certainly in subsequent writing about punk, historical writing, critical writing, etc., there's always this question, well, I mean, what is the thing you're talking about when you're talking about punk? Are you talking about, for example, a definable subgenre of rock music? Is that what you're talking about? A particular kind of rock music characterized by relatively low technical skills on the part of the musicians, or, you know, it's not very technically demanding, apart from that you have to more or less play in time quite fast. You know, a fast bat beat, a fast bass line, and sort of quickly strummed distorted guitars or thrash guitars, and these sort of shouted vocals. Is that what you're talking about? Or, in fact, are you talking about something which is more amorphous? It has nothing whatsoever to do with a particular style of music. You know, one of my favourite ever quotes about the concept of punk is Martin Fry, the lead singer of ABC, the Sheffield group that would be sort of central to the emergence of the new pop and new romanticism in the early 80s.
One of my favourites.
Yeah, great band. I would say Lexicon of Love is the only great British disco album. There are other great British singles, but it's the only album's worth of great British disco music by a singular band. But he famously said, "I am," while wearing his gold lamé suit and his kind of, you know, carefully coiffed hair. You know, it's looking a bit like a sort of early 50s crooner or something. So it said, "I am and always have been a punk." So this question of whether punk is a thing, is it a style, is it a genre, is it an attitude, is always hanging around. And one idea I've often put forward to students is that, well, actually, the two ways of conceptualizing punk are to think of it either as a style of music, and you're talking about punk rock, really, or to think of it as a kind of historical event, a thing that somehow that happens, after which all kinds of other cultural possibilities become possible. You know, it becomes possible for a guy from Sheffield and his mates with some synthesizers to try to create a kind of reinterpretation of the lush sound of Philly disco. You know, it becomes possible to do that somehow because of a thing that has happened in the mid-70s. And the name for the thing that has happened is punk. Partly I say that because for a really long time in British music writing and in the British music press, it was this absolutely given assumption that somehow, like, the event, not just the most important event, but somehow the thing which was the thing against which all other possible events had to be judged was the event of punk. Yeah, I remember. I remember it became like a joke, really, with people who were kind of writing about rave by the end of the 90s. That, you know, the question that most journalists and older kind of cultural commentators still wanted to ask about rave was always, was it as important as punk? Was it as big a deal as punk? You know, the assumption being that, of course, punk was a huge deal, the hugest deal, the ultimate kind of a deal that could ever have happened. Because, I mean, that was always a really problematic assumption. And one of the things we'll get into at some point is, you know, punk as a one of the features of punk as a cultural phenomenon, especially in Britain, to a certain extent, with some people in places like New York as well, is, well, it was a thing that was really, really important to a particular kind of person. And that particular kind of person ended up being very highly represented in key sort of media circles over the 80s and 90s. So the idea of punk as having been like massively important became a really a central element, almost of a sort of generational ideology for a certain cohort of people. To some extent, it was something that people like myself and Tim, you know, had to sort of push against when we were trying to get taken seriously for writing about dance music at the end of the 80s. And of course, you know, there's also, as well as seeing punk as an event, you know, it's quite normal to talk about punk, as I've said, as an attitude, a vibe, in Raymond Williams's terms, a structure of feeling. And of course, in that, you know, notoriously overused and problematic term, a subculture. So there are all these different ways in which punk might be conceptualized. And we'll just keep coming back to this. I don't think there's one correct answer to the question, like, what kind of thing is punk? But I think it's important to keep in mind that it is a question. And that to some extent, when we're talking about punk, we're talking about all of those things at once. I don't know if you were as conscious as I was, Tim, in the 90s of having to sort of push against this, because I guess maybe writing about New York, it wasn't quite the same. Like writing about British culture, it was like, you know, when Ewan Pearson and I put in our book proposal for our book discographies about rave culture at the end of the 90s, the main pushback we got from reviewers of the main pushback we got was in our claim that rave might be as important as punk, possibly even more important than punk. Like that was the only thing. They didn't mind us like wanting to write a book using like Lucia Rigorai to theorize like house music, but the idea that something might have been more important than punk, no, that's a shocking statement to make.
Or else you're expected to say that rave was inspired by punk.
Yeah, it was the new punk. It was
the new punk. It was all about DIY culture, basically. Punk became sort of a form of DIY, didn't it? Yeah, it's true. I didn't. That wasn't an issue for me when I was trying to write Love Saves the Day. And there was even it wasn't even particularly clear that punk had even sort of happened in an explicit way in New York. It very quickly seemed to be known as New Wave. And the institutions of punk weren't particularly strong, and it didn't have the same kind of media effect at all, I think, in the United States. I mean, I think the Sex Pistols obviously toured the United States, and they behaved, you know, in a pretty contentious way in some of those shows, and they may not have gone down that well, but it never kind of, I don't think they had the same level of kind of media publicity in the States. And I don't know if they did get banned from the radio. I don't think it was particularly big. It wasn't like a big story, but I don't think they were. But I mean, one thing that does spring to mind with all of this is there are some interesting parallels with disco.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to get distracted on this, and I think we should probably...
No, I think there are. I think you're right. It's a good point.
But one of the, you know, one of the, I mean, part, as you know very well, indeed, one of my, you know, one thing I did in Love Saves the Day, which meant that I didn't make as much money out of it by far as might have been the case, is I didn't use the word disco in the title, because to me there was a long prehistory to what became known as disco. Disco didn't really come through until the summer of 1974. We've talked about this in earlier episodes, of course. We're halfway through the decade before, you know, disco becomes a thing and is named. And even then, it takes a couple of years until it really becomes more pervasive or more widely recognized. So it's kind of parallels punk really quickly, really interestingly. Punk also isn't really properly in circulation as a term until about 1976. Maybe it's even 77. It's probably 76, isn't it? With the Sex Pistols breaking through, it's just very late in history. I mean, we often identify the 70s as being dominated by disco and punk, but in some ways, both of them arrived very late, and both of them were over kind of, you could say, prematurely. I mean, as you said at the opening of the show, punk it takes very little time before, you know, post-punk sort of begins to come through, and in the United States the term is never really properly adopted to, you know, market bands such as Talking Heads and Blondie and others. So New Wave is obviously, and New Wave is quite good as a term because it suggests a kind of, you know, a possible progressive position on art and politics, which is, I think, what's going on here. I agree on some level. I mean, well, I agree with everything you said in the intro that we can look at punk in these two ways. But if we look at it as music, and we're going to listen to a bunch of tracks soon, and it's going through the tracks that you were suggesting for this show and listening to them and thinking quite carefully, is this punk music? And then wondering if it really is what we think of as punk made me end up thinking even more, well, where is it? Where is this music? When does it really start and how quickly does it end? Because it gets to be a sort of a smaller and smaller window, arguably. I mean, or maybe I'm just wrong about this. I also think the same is true about disco. I don't think Philly Soul is just straight up disco. You know, you can make a case that, you know, The Love I Lost is a disco record because Earl Young keeps four on the floor with the bass drum. But, you know, to me, you can say TSOP, Sound of Philadelphia by MFSB, that's kind of disco. And it's like one of the worst records to ever come out on Philadelphia International, arguably. And that's, you know, again, it's coming already coming a little bit late, but it's all I'm suggesting is that when you start to try and really work out when punk music started to actually happen and even be caught and understood as punk music, is quite late, and it's sort of similar to disco in that way. So that's, and I think that with the other thing that's striking with punk is that is in terms of the more political or philosophical position is, I think it's on some level it's about freedom and expression and really opposing the stagnation of the post, you know, the underlying politics of the post-war settlement, which were hierarchical and highly structured and suffocating, and in many cases also overtly reactionary politically. So it was partly about that, and it was partly about just wanting to you know, be all anti-authoritarian and to just find ways of doing things that people hadn't really been doing that much previously. And I guess sometimes punk is understood to be something which is anti-countercultural on some sort of level, but it's part of the same, in many respects, it's part of the same movement, which is just deciding that, you know, accepted institutions and received wisdom and dominant ideology needs to be challenged. So it's all part of this continuum. And, I did end up arguing in a piece I wrote not that long ago, just drawing together sort of what I've been trying to say in the books, but see how I might try and write that in sort of like 20 or 30 pages. You know, you have a series of sometimes small, sometimes larger grassroots, you know, movements that are quite organic, and they often revolve around music, that emerge in the late 1960s, but they certainly accelerate during the 1970s. And they're all doing the same thing in a way. They're all, it's these groups of people who are disenfranchised who come together around music. And an awful lot of them do it around DJ culture, but an awful lot of them also do it around like rock culture. And they're just all doing the same thing. So we often look back and see all this conflict and antagonism between these groups, but it just didn't really exist at that, whilst these cultures were unfolding. There's something of a construct, sort of say, like, you know, punk hated disco and disco hated punk and all the rest of it. And there was an element of that, but if punk hated disco, it hated sort of midtown disco. But then the parties and the DJs that we've been interested in also didn't have any time for midtown disco. By the time, you know, people who were part of this punk scene or post-punk scene or new wave scene in New York City, by the time they get to find out that places like The Loft or The Paradise Garage, etc., even exist, they think it's incredible immediately. It may not be where they want to hang out the whole time, but there's an immediate affinity, just as there's an immediate affinity between the downtown punk scene and the Bronx party scene, what becomes known as hip-hop.
Without music, life would be a mistake.
One of the things that's happening is the turn to sort of heavier kinds of rock in sections of the counterculture and sections of the rock scene from the late 60s onwards is initially understood as explicitly politically. It is understood as a sort of critique of, I mean, a critique of like 1967 flower power. But it's a critique from the point of view of a radicalizing counterculture. And even as we've said before, you know, this stuff gets mixed up in people's minds in the historiography. Like the hippies of 1967 aren't really counterculture. I've made this point loads of times before. Yeah, the Beatles do All You Need Is Love for the first ever global satellite broadcast. You know, it's not counterculture. It's on the BBC. I think they're occupying the mainstream. And it's within the next couple of years that the idea of counterculture properly emerges. And it emerges as people start to realize that, oh, just singing All You Need Is Love isn't going to end the Vietnam War. You're going to have to fight this stuff. And the turn to more kind of angry kinds of music and angry sorts of aesthetics like is absolutely part of that process. So I think punk is really better understood as a sort of, to some extent, a kind of internal radicalization of the counterculture and of the rock counterculture anyway. But as we're about to see, you know, there are always a confusing mixture of elements within punk as an idea. And also right from the beginning of punk, you know, there's an element which is sort of nostalgic and possibly even sort of reactionary. But we'll see that. I think it's about time we hear a bit of music. We've been talking so long, let's hear a bit of music straight away. The first record we're going to play today is from 1966. This is a record by an LA band, often referred to as a psychedelic garage band. This is the Seeds, and this is their big hit from 66, Pushing Too Hard. All right, now why am I playing that? Because at the time when that was released in 1966, punk rock wasn't a term, it wasn't a concept. But one of the first places the term punk gets used to refer to a style of music is in this really fascinating musical, I don't know what to call it, document artifact, but the word itself, the word artifact appears in the title of the thing. It's a compilation album. There's this compilation album released in 1972 by Elektra Records called Nuggets. Nuggets, original artifacts, and artifacts is spelled with a Y, A-R-T-Y, from the first psychedelic era. The compilation is put together by Lenny Kaye, who is a writer and is working in a record shop in somewhere in the village in New York, and would go on to become the lead guitarist for Patti Smith. And it's a compilation of garage rock and kind of very early, quote unquote, psychedelic singles from the mid to late 60s. And what they all have now, this term garage rock, we talked about this on one of the Patrons episodes recently. I've probably talked about it before, but it's a term that starts to be used just at this moment for a cohort of American rock bands, very much influenced by people like the Beatles, who are active from about 64, 65 onwards. And they're called garage rock because typically they were teenagers who would be rehearsing in their parents' suburban garages, like playing at local venues, even playing at high school events. And what's really kind of interesting is at the moment when this comes out, this is only 1972. Then there's this nostalgic looking back to that moment. If you want the British equivalents of these bands would be the mod rock bands. The British equivalent to these bands would be the Small Faces and the Who. It's quite similar kind of vibe, very kind of energetic rock. There's a very, you can hear on the sound of the music. You know, on the Seeds, you've got there's a lot of organ, which they're sort of borrowing a bit from strands of rhythm and blues and soul. There's a kind of aspiration to have something of the rawness of energy, of the raw end of soul music, but they're not good enough musicians or singers usually to do that. So you end up with this sort of quite distinctive kind of high energy white rock. The lyrics are just not political at all. The lyrics are, you're pushing too hard on me. And yeah, the lyrics are often, as I often say about the Who and the Small Faces, you know, on their first couple of albums at least, they're all about the perfidy of their girlfriends. But already then in 1972, there's this compilation comes out, and it's the first example I know of in music history of an influential compilation album, of a compilation album going on to sort of shape musical practice and a musical genre in this way. And it collects together these relatively obscure singles, and it sort of romanticizes them already from the perspective of 1972, which is really interesting to think about. I mean, what's happening in 1972? Well, if you followed the history on the show at all, you will probably be aware that by 1972, it is becoming quite apparent to people that the promise of the post-war dream is disintegrating. In a way, it wasn't yet clearly disintegrating in 1965, 66. And nostalgia for 65, 66, for that moment, for the last moment, really, when wages, especially for young working class men, were going up every year, will be a recurrent feature, actually, of rock music culture right through to Britpop in the 90s and even maybe later, for completely understandable reasons. Like, if you're a white working class man, then 1966 is the greatest time in history, especially to be very young. And everything since then has been sort of downhill. So that's part of the reason. But there's also this sense that there's something about the raw energy and in particular the youthfulness of these groups that really seems to be appealing. And the term punk is used as a term not of kind of insult, but a term of approbation in the liner notes for this record. And it's one of the first usages of the term. Now, it might not be the first usage. it seems to be consistent in which the way the term is being used, particularly by a group of music writers in a magazine called Cream, C-R-E-E-M, which is publishing at the same time, which is edited by Lester Bangs at this time, the kind of arch guru of like American punk criticism, the person who really canonized Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground and Iggy Pop and the Stooges. And there is this emerging aesthetic, this emerging idea that there's a particular kind of preferences which somehow express like the true, authentic, rebellious, youthful spirit of rock and roll, which has somehow been lost by the abstract intellectual over sophistication of progressive rock or advanced acid rock. And in particular, I think people feel like it's not really relevant to the lives of young people in the cities. I mean, it is interesting to reflect at this moment in 1972, the hippies have basically left San Francisco. I mean, they're not there anymore. The Haight-Ashbury is over. And most of those guys, what they have done, a lot of them, they have moved out into the countryside or they have moved up the coast to Oregon to kind of live on farms, to set up things like the Oregon Country Fair, which is, you know, you can still go to every year, I think, if you want to. So, but if you are left behind, if you are left living in the cities, if you haven't managed to go with your old lady and your van to get and your minibus to go set up a commune in the countryside, then the music these people, the kind of pastoral music that's coming out of the legatees of that scene, doesn't seem that relevant to you. What seems more relevant to you is a kind of a harder edge sound which speaks to the deteriorating social and economic conditions that you seem to be experiencing. A really central to that with this first wave of writing in magazines like Cream about what was coming to be referred to occasionally already actually as punk rock, central wasn't just this kind of nostalgic looking back to teen high school bands from the mid-60s. It was also the veneration of a particular couple of bands, especially from the Motor City itself, from Detroit. The key bands there would be the MC5 and the Stooges. But have you got any thoughts about Nuggets and that kind of looking back to garage rock before I go on to the MC5, Tim?
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that was going to be, it was the reference point that this record had appeared on that compilation. So that's really interesting to hear. Yeah, I mean, when I listened to the record and thinking, okay, so how was this punk? And my first reaction, or one of my first thoughts was, I really like the record a great deal. I didn't particularly know it. I thought, damn, I might buy this and play it at a party. I mean, it's like I wasn't expecting to get too many music tips during this episode, so that was a pleasant surprise.
I've just realised I did play it at parties a couple of times, and it's the only... I think it was in my box of singles that got stolen from the Total Refreshment Centre. I think... Just reminded me of that. You all needed to know that, listeners.
I didn't steal them. No,
I know you didn't.
I don't know what's going on here. But I'm not going to confess on air anyway. So no, so there's that. And I mean, well, so my, and then I decided, no, I don't think I can get away with this because the lyrics are too, you know, problematic.
So it's very harsh on the sound system. It sounds very, the harshness comes out more on the sound system than it does on digital.
The lyrics just too much about, like, well, you know, there's plenty of, if you're pushing me too hard, girl, and, you know, if you keep doing this, well, there's plenty of fish in the sea. And I'm like, I don't really want to be playing this.
No. There's so many Bob Dylan songs are about that. It's so awful. If you want to hear, like, why women's liberation was necessary, like, I've said something like this on the Patrons episode, and I'll say it again here because we're about to talk about the Stooges. It's not the kind of hyper-masculine rock of like the Stooges you want to listen to hear why women's liberation was necessary. It's people like Dylan, like constantly sneering at the imagined women in their stories. And like, you know, he's constantly sort of slightly complaining about how they're a bit too demanding of them and they don't quite get what geniuses they are and ought to just leave them alone. It's just appalling. Yeah.
So the intersection with punk. Well, first of all, this is rock and roll, and I think this becomes a bit of an ongoing theme for me. And interestingly, I'm not really doing it at this precise moment, but I have been trying to dig into rock and roll a little bit, and just
because I'm sure there is a lot of good music there that is just still fit, sounds very fresh and dynamic, but I haven't managed to uncover that many records so far. But this it did fit into that feel of something that's just, it's instrumental, it's grooving, it's tight. The bit that feels a bit punk-like to me is indeed this kind of, is the slightly snarly vocals, yes. Slightly quietly aggressive, and sort of complaining, basically, as you yourself said. Yeah. It's like, I mean, the object of complaint isn't that noble, but that sense of dissatisfaction, of having sort of had enough, also just makes this, it's interesting. The argument about this becoming a point of nostalgia is very interesting, but within the moment there's something where there's a bit of complaint going on as well. I guess people always complain, won't they? But I think that's, it may be why it continues to resonate in particular, because it's not too sunny and optimistic.
Yeah Okay, well, it's interesting to contrast it, I think, with, as already promised, the next record I want to listen to. I want to listen to something by the MC5. There's only really one can play by the MC5, and that is the title track of their 1965 first album, Kick Out the Jams. So let's hear a bit of that. The MC5, the Motor City 5, were widely seen, at least for a couple of years, around 1968, 1970, as really the leading edge of what was emerging as hard rock. And in many ways, I think it's sort of harder to hear them as punk than it is to hear like the Seeds, to me, in a way, because they're more musically accomplished. It's heavier, it's louder, it's kind of very extreme. Although their lyrics, to be honest, their lyrics always seem pretty banal to me. They do have something which I think you do hear in the music, although maybe I'm just hearing it because I know about the history. And that is to do with the fact that they are very, very explicitly political and politicized. They start off as this kind of hard rock band. They become part of the kind of radical wing of the counterculture. They get taken under the wing of a guy called John Sinclair, who's a fascinating cultural and political activist. He's involved with things like the Yippies, the Youth International Party, and the White Panthers, which is not, as you might fear, a white supremacist organization, but was an organization specifically set up so that white people could join something which meant that they explicitly supported the Black Panthers. And they actually play, I mean, the MC5, for example, they play a gig as part of the protests again at the Democratic National Convention in 1968, the notorious convention, which ends in police brutality against protesters and many, many arrests, and is often seen as the kind of the point at which the American kind of new left, you know, took a more radical militant turn. And they're managed by this guy, John Sinclair, who like won't call himself their manager because that would be pro-capitalist. His record label strokes or production company is called Trans Love Energies. He eventually gets put in prison for a while on completely pretty trumped up, I think, charges of marijuana possession. But that, yeah, this is the moment when they're just going around and nicking people like Timothy Leary. Then they're using marijuana possession as the charge, as an excuse to put people in prison for what are basically political crimes. Kick Out the Jams, the album, comes out in 1969. Very interesting, it's a live album. It's very unusual for a debut album to be a live album. And it says something about the way in which a kind of punk rock aesthetic would come to really sort of venerate the idea of spontaneity, the idea of the pure capture of a live performance as preferable to the sort of studio artistry that was starting to define the production work of people like George Martin, the work of people like Pink Floyd, etc. So there was something about an aspiration to realness and realism and rawness and authenticity. I've got to say, the record itself, the album itself, I've always felt like it doesn't quite live up to all this political aspiration. A lot of it it's sort of heavy rock. A lot of it sounds to me like it's more influenced by Hendrix than anything else, but they don't really have anyone who can do the solos that Hendrix can do. And I mean, just kick out the jams as a lyric. It's like, what? I mean, it's like a party anthem, basically. I want to kick out the jams. But they're really sort of fascinating, and they occupy this key point in the transition to the emergence of something like punk rock. And there's another link with Patti Smith, because their lead guitarist, Fred Sonic Smith, would end up being married to Patti Smith for, you know, for many, many years. I mean, until he died, they had a very happy relationship, as I understand it. So it is very interesting that at this moment of the kind of first emergence of something like punk rock, then there's this very explicit allegiance with the radical anti-capitalist wing of the counterculture.
To what extent did their activism kind of, was it developed?
I don't know. I think it was benefits, basically. They just played lots and lots of shows, so like at demonstrations and at benefits. I have a vague recollection that they like a lot of people, they became a little bit disillusioned with the kind of the defeat of militancy and the kind of disaggregation of the militant movement into little left-wing sets. They couldn't really get anywhere. But I don't think they ever abandoned, you know, their sort of political commitments.
So, I mean, the lyrics, again, they're not that dissimilar to the Seeds in some way. I mean, they are a bit, I mean, women are sort of positioned as the recipients of sort of male pleasure, as far as I can tell. But in this case, the male pleasure is like the music that they're generating.
The Yippie slogan was, I can't remember now, drugs, love and fucking in the street, something like that. So there was this idea that like out and out sexuality.
But that's not gendered, right? That's not about women. That's not about men giving it to a woman, sort of thing.
No, but there's a grey area, isn't there? It's quite similar, actually. I think it's sometimes said that one of the first artists to call himself a punk or musicians was the guy, I've already forgotten his name, but he was the lead singer of the Fugs, this weird little kind of New York, again, sort of deliberately sort of proto-punk, but almost a sort of comedy band in some ways from the late 60s. And the Fugs as well, they were sort of mates with people like Robert Crumb. There's all this kind of zone of countercultural activity where very quite lewd expressions of overt male sexuality, like they might just be expressing a kind of liberated sensibility, but they might be expressing a will to objectify women in precisely the way that, you know, the people who were doing women's liberation at just the same moment, you know, felt.
I was that's interesting. I mean, it's ambiguous, I guess, is what you're saying, but I'm just trying to check this now, and because I did a quick search as well on MC5 in my own notes, just to see what came up, and not a lot did come up, which is not that surprising. But one thing that did come up that I just thought I'd mention in passing is that Anita Sarko, who we will start to talk about maybe in some future series, well, I'm sure we will, but she starts to, the Mud Club opens, if I'm not misremembering, it's Halloween 1978, and Anita Sarko starts to DJ there quite soon after. And she is one of the key pioneering female DJs in the city, and as she might even have it, above being a pioneering female DJ, she's a pioneering DJ, and so we might want to call her post-punk. But the Mud Club was often thought of as a punk discotheque, and Anita Sarko, and indeed the people who were going to the Mud Club and the people who are running the Mud Club, it was a lot more open than just being punk, which sort of lends itself to the definition of punk that you were opening, the second definition of punk that you opened the show with, Jem, that it's something which is, it's a sort of political, philosophical position more than a set of coordinated sounds or distinctive sounds.
Okay, well, let's get on to the next Detroit band. So, apologies, not really apologies, insincere apologies to patrons who've listened to me wax lyrical about the Stooges on the episode that we did about glam. I think it was the second one, I think. And Also, keen-eared listeners will remember that we did an episode, I think a couple of years ago now, called So Good They Named It Twice, about New York in 75. When we talked about a lot of the sort of New York punk stroke proto-punk bands. And I should have already said this at the top of this show. We are going to be leaving out some really obvious landmarks on the road to anarchy in the UK, including people like Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers and Suicide. Suicide also very early users of the term punk to describe themselves. And the reason for that is because we did this episode a couple of years ago. The episode is called So Good They Named It Twice.
The episode, just to clarify, the episode was on the fiscal crisis in New York in 1975 and a wider economic deterioration that produced these. It wasn't a show about punk that we're just lazily repeating. I know you weren't saying that, but there was a minor ambiguity.
No, sure, that's right. But we included all these people like Richard Hale and Patti Smith. So. And I did play a track from the Stooges' first album on the episode about the New Left, but we're now going to play another one. Let's play the title track from the Stooges' seminal 1970 album, Funhouse. So, the Stooges. Iggy Pop, so called because he had been in a high school band called the Iguanas. Lead singer of the Stooges. Really, arguably, the first iconic figure of punk. I would say my understanding from the source material is that several of the articles in Cream magazine that started to popularize the term punk to refer to a particular style of rock music or a particular attitude in rock music were specifically referring to Iggy Pop. And the Stooges, sort of heavy, very intense style of heavy rock, very heavy rock music is, of all the possible sources, it's the one that most of what would come to be called punk bands, especially in Britain, actually, in the 70s, 76, are citing as a direct antecedent, as a direct influence. It's Iggy and the Stooges who really are seen as somehow anticipating punk. Although at the same time, you know, both of their first two albums, all their albums, but it's the first two, it's the 69 and 70 albums that are really seminal. They're very different from what would come to be known as punk rock in a lot of ways. The music is slower, the bass line is heavier, the sound is much more spacious, and I mean, it's formally more difficult what they're doing, and the arrangements are a bit more complicated. Like, it doesn't sound like they're trying to sound like teenagers who've just learned to play their instruments, which becomes a kind of signature feature of punk rock. You know, it doesn't sound like that. And I tried to give some expression to this in the glam episode with patrons, but I'll say a bit about it again. There is something about even the lyrics, which, although they're very simple, they're often very poignant. There's something about the lyrics and the vocal delivery and the style that always gives the impression that while this is a music which is all about male angst, it's not male angst like aimed at women. It's not from the point of view of the kind of sneering man who sort of thinks of women as slightly beneath his attention. Like, Iggy Pop always sounds like he hates himself, not necessarily like he hates the girl to whom the song might be addressing. And there's something really sort of fascinating about that. That's why it is the kind of year zero, the ground zero of a certain lineage, which is going to end up including people like Nirvana, for example, of a sort of masculinist rock, but which is sort of counter-masculinist. You know, it's using kind of masculinist musical tropes to engage in a sort of critique of normative masculinity, I think, which is part, you know, it's experiencing normative masculinity as a painful mode of subjectivity rather than just a position from which to dominate women or complain about them. There's a kind of cathartic quality to the music, which I think it's very interesting. Like, for me, one of the things about what comes to be definitive typical punk rock is, like, what is it for? Is it's music kind of jumping around in the mosh pit on speed too. It's music which gets you very frenetic and excited, but there's never any sense of release in it. There's never this sense of release in kind of classic, the classic punk rock single. The classic punk rock track is really trying to fulfill the criterion established by Lou Reed when he once said the music of the Velvet Underground was quite deliberately all about being uptight. The thing about the Stooges is they're not really uptight. In fact, one of the great songs on this album, Funhouse, is just called Loose. It's not really about being uptight. It's about experiencing that same uptightness that the punks are always giving voice to, but also somehow just releasing it in an absolute kind of howl of rage. And it's a howl of catharsis. And that howl of catharsis is very much influenced by not just, you know, garage bands. It's influenced by free jazz. You know, they would, the MC5 as well, actually, but you hear it more on the Stooges, would cite people like John Coltrane and Albert Eiler as influences. They saw themselves as sometimes trying to do with the kind of scream and wail of the distorted electric guitar, what people like Albert Eiler were doing with the saxophone. So to me, there is something that sort of transcends any simple idea of punk rock, or maybe it anticipates a version of the idea of punk rock, a version of punk rock which will always be sort of an avant-garde project rather than just one which is looking back to some idealized, simpler kind of rock and roll.
I mean, we're only talking about this in terms of punk because the term emerges, and then we all go backwards and try and work out when did it start. And sometimes include things in that definition that seem to make sense but weren't necessarily understood to be punk at the time, and or let's say disco. And this was, I don't know, when I listened to this, it was blues. It felt like, you know, rock-oriented blues music again.
Yes, yes.
It was very and a surprising amount of, like, a surprise. I'd have to listen to it one more time because this almost semi occurred to me now, not entirely, sort of elements of funk as well.
Well, the funny story about that is when, you know, I had really, you know, I've talked about this on the Patrons episode, but hearing this record for the first time was a big deal when I was a teenager. It took me and my friends months to get hold of a copy of it, having read about it. We were completely blown away by it, partly because it seemed to confirm our suspicion that the kind of grunge music that people were getting so excited about out of Seattle was completely unoriginal, that this had all been done like 20 years previously and better by these guys from Detroit. So we're really excited by it. And then it was only, I remember it was a few months after that, because, you know, we weren't exposed to lots of kinds of music you might easily be exposed to today through streaming. It was the first time we heard one of the late 60s James Brown. And I remember my friend turned to me, the same friend actually, Mark, my friend Mark Dixon, turned to me and said, it's like the Stooges. And yeah, it's like the Stooges. And it was, you know, and that was our feeling, yeah. And then we said, and of course I replied, well, I suppose the Stooges were getting it from him. And he said, yes, of course. Like, it's not like we didn't realize that. But yeah, that affinity is very much there. It is very much there. Yeah.
I mean, there's horns.
Yeah.
And they keep, first of all, they keep the rhythm.
Yeah.
I mean, it is complete groove music.
Yeah.
And the groove is basically danceable. It's not just any old groove music.
Yes.
It's kind of up tempo. The horn keeps the rhythm, which is what happens in funk, as we know, and in many ways R&B, of course, before it. And then the horn goes into jazz almost. It gets more complex, but then it's incredible the way that the playing is amazing. I mean, this is one reason why this doesn't really sound like punk music as well, is because the playing is so good. There's so much emphasis on like tight musicianship. The drums are really clean. The guitar playing is very precise. There's no thrashing. Lyrics are sort of clearly sung, not shouted. I mean, they're very emotive, which you can see why Iggy Pop starts to become, you know, quickly becomes close with Bowie, and they share various projects together. As we were talking about again on this, you know, increasingly self-referenced glam episode that you have to become a patron in order to listen to. No, anyway. So it's all these things. And then it's like bloody hell, Iggy Pop is like James Brown. He screams, he grunts. You know, it's pre-Michael Jackson's version of James Brown, basically, on some level.
Yes.
But that's the reference point.
Yes, totally. It totally is, yeah. There's no question that it is, yeah.
And I was just thinking, again, for the second time, it's like, blooming hell, I think I wouldn't, you know, haven't heard this for
many a year, and this sounds really playable. I mean, it gets quite intense.
Yeah, it's too much. And this is quite early on for a party. There's a couple of tracks from the first album that Sed and I have played at parties years
ago. Yeah, no, I totally agree. Like, you certainly it would be early, but even then, it's a little on the disruptive side.
Yeah.
I mean, it just tips over to the point where it can feel a bit aggressive.
Well, I wouldn't play this at a party the same reason I don't play John Coltrane at parties. It's too much, but I still love it.
But there's a continuum with a lot of music that does get played at parties.
Yes,
there's
totally,
it's a lot more in common than distinguishing it. So that was my feeling about this as well. It's blues, it's R&B, it's funk with forceful kind of guitar playing in some ways. Or the vocal delivery, but that's the allegiance. I mean, one of the things that's the point of all this, I suppose, this that I'm throwing out seemingly randomly, is that this is a long way from the Ramones, basically, on some level. And they're a big part of the Ramones, and arguably links they had to elements of let's say racist or even fascist discourse or whatever. And I've never read up on this properly to know to what extent it's valid to suggest this, but certainly there was an element in the Ramones of like, let's stop imitating black people, let's stop worshipping black music, and let's sound as if we're white. This was kind of part of the discourse. I mean, Lester Bangs was highly critical of it, in fact. But if we're going to the Stooges, there's none of that. There's the reference points of black music in many ways.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Yeah, that really has helped clarify something that's honestly been bothering me since I was a teenager, actually. Because, well, how do you fit this record into the idea of punk rock? Because it's not punk. It's not what punk became. And yet, punk is the term. I mean, I'm going to say this. What is at stake, even in 1972, in the fact that these writers like Lester Bangs, the term they want to apply to Iggy Pop is punk. I think they don't understand what Iggy Pop and the Stooges are doing, actually. I think they have quite a poor understanding of what they're doing. I don't think they understand properly the extent to which they are not a break with, but a sort of continuation of the white rock dialogue with funk and blues and soul. They don't understand the extent to which actually what the Stooges are doing. They're actually doing what those British like mod bands wanted to do, but couldn't really do. They're doing a kind of white rock, which is fully informed by soul and jazz. That's what they're doing. And they're more of a piece with people like Miles Davis than they are with, the kind of pleasant ditties of a Jonathan Richman or people like that. So, and from that point of view, there's always been a problem, I think, with a certain kind of punk-centered rock historiography that really wants to create a lineage out of these quite disparate elements. And in the process, I think it really sort of misreads the radicalism of what some of the components are doing. You can have a quite different history of this music, which would understand, I think, sort of Patti Smith and the Stooges as being in doing something quite different, and something which in its way is much more continuous with the psychedelic movement, for example, from what, the Ramones are going to end up doing. So there's something problematic all along about calling this punk, and about putting the Iggy Pop alongside sort of the Seeds or whatever. There's something quite problematic about it. But that is what happens. That is what happens to that's how the category gets invented. It gets invented by putting this particular set of things together and identifying them.
It's the same with disco.
Yeah, it's the same with disco. Yeah.
David Mancuso told me again and again and again, and he said that Larry Levan said the same thing. It's R&B music.
Yeah.
Basically. Why do we need, so the soul comes along and stuff, but that's R&B plus some gospel, but basically it's blues. It's the blues continuum. There comes to a point where there is a break with it, where it doesn't sound like blues music, and maybe that happens with the Ramones. We'll go on to talk about that. Maybe it happens with the Sex Pistols. There's a point where rock music doesn't sound like blues music, or guitar music doesn't necessarily sound like blues music, but we're not there yet.
No, I think that's right. And I think, I mean, for me, what's really striking is despite the complaints, even the complaints in 1969 that I talked about in the New Left episode, you have the Stooges song that says that it's 1969, okay, war across the USA. There's no nostalgia here. And that there's a strand of punk and what will become post-punk, which is it is sort of anti-nostalgia. And it will include people like Talking Heads. It will include people like ABC. But there's also a strand which right from the beginning is nostalgic. And that's the strand which is already kind of looking, you know, being misty-eyed about these, you know, often quite mediocre, like high school bands on compilations like Nuggets. And all those things are both running through the idea of punk right from the beginning. All right, thanks very much, Tim. That was great. Thanks, everybody. You will hear us next time. Thanks very much. And we've mentioned several times on the episode, on this episode, that if you are a patron of the show, if you can get, for example, our recent excellent short series on glam rock, which is a key antecedent of punk, of course. If you don't have the means to support us in that way, then by all means, we're very happy that you're listening to the show anyway. If you get a couple of spare minutes, do just leave us a 5-star rating on a platform, because as you hopefully know, it helps the show prosper at no cost to yourself.
If prosper.
Prosper. I used the word prosper, as in live wow. long and is prosper.
Did I miss something?
So let's just.
I wondered where you got your mink coat from that I can see you wearing right now.
Yeah, we didn't. Matt and I decided you didn't really need to know about
audience ratings going through the roof.
No. All right.
Great. Okay.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Thanks. Yeah.
Bye. Bye.